Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Scott Redder, and Scott is going to talk about arms control. So, you know, you're a keen observer of what's going on. Tell us a little bit about arms control that we should know.
Well, the first thing everybody should realize is that in a world where nuclear weapons have become commonplace, and let me even back this up. You know, a lot of people today, you know, hear the term nuclear weapon. They look at the TV and they see the flash and the bang and the boom, but it's not real to them. People who grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, anybody who experienced a nuclear bomb drill, getting under, you know, duck and cover, get under your table. Anybody who, like myself, lived on the front line of the Cold War, where, you know, the Soviets hiccuped and your father went into a bunker and you lived next door to a special weapons storage area that would be hit by a nuclear weapon if war ever started, meaning that you'd be dead at any moment. You never knew when it could happen. You learned to take nuclear weapons serious. They were a daily part of your reality. And you learn to respect the fact that these weapons can not only kill you, but kill all of humanity. And that's something that needs to be emphasized, all of humanity. And this is why in the 1960s and 70s, the United States and the Soviet Union, recognizing that they were sitting on arsenals that would end life as we know it, sought to reduce the risk of these weapons being used. And you did this by arms control, at first putting limitations on the numbers of weapons and the types of weapons you could build, and then later on actually starting to reduce them, bring them down, draw them down, make the numbers smaller, and in doing so, seek to limit the circumstances under which the use of these weapons could even be considered. You know, when you have nuclear deterrence, that is, both nations looking at one another, recognizing that if I use a nuclear weapon against you, you will use a nuclear weapon against me, and it's mutually assured destruction. And that, you know, MAD was the acronym that was used. When you have that taking place, you have stability. But then you have to recognize that mutually assured destruction is in and of itself insanity. And so why not just eliminate nuclear weapons and head towards zero? So that's where we are in arms control. And it applies as well to other so-called weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, biological weapons, weapons that society has recognized possess a ability to kill well beyond a military battlefield. That is, that a chemical agent or a biological agent, like a nuclear weapon, if used even in a military context, will kill, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of civilians. So, you know, civilized society, for what it is said, we're not going to have these weapons. And so arms control is the processes by which nations come together to limit and reduce weapons that pose a mass threat to society, and it exists in the form of bilateral treaties between, for instance, the United States and the Soviet Union, or the United States and Russia, or multilateral treaty arrangements such as the Chemical Weapons Convention or the Biological Weapons Convention. It can also be imposed on a nation by the United Nations, such as what occurred with Iraq, where the United Nations made the determination that Iraq could no longer possess chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, or long-range ballistic missiles, and an arms control regime was imposed on Iraq. So it's a mechanism that can exist either bilaterally or multilaterally, designed to eliminate weapons that pose an inherent risk to society, to global society.
Okay, so, you know, we're in the process of a transition from one administration to the other. Give us a little background of Trump's handling of arms control and what you expect from the Biden administration.
Well, I think to answer that, we have to talk about an American approach, because you know Trump was not unique in his approach, and neither will Biden be. You know, the American approach was to respect arms control so long as it was seen as being beneficial to America. Back in the day when the Soviet Union existed, and the Russians had 40,000 nuclear weapons, it was definitely in our interest to engage in arms control to limit these weapons and reduce these weapons. This is why we had the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, SALT Treaty. This is why we did the START Treaty, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, why we did the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty to eliminate those weapons, because it was seen to be in our interest to do this. This is why we entered in what's called the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, because we were looking at 100,000 Soviet tanks ready to run roughshod over Europe, and so we decided the best way to safeguard our interests was to come up with a treaty that reduced this arsenal, moved it away from the borders, and created the potential for peace. This is why we entered what's called the Open Skies Treaty, so that we could have unarmed aircraft loaded with reconnaissance equipment flying over nations to take photographs to help create confidence that there wasn't a secret military buildup taking place. So the United States entered into all of these agreements. This is why we entered into the Iran nuclear deal, another arms control agreement, where we decided it was in our interest to put in place a mechanism to put controls over Iran's nuclear program. We entered the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty in 1972, which basically said, the best way we prevent nuclear weapons from ever being used is to make sure we understand that if they're used, everybody dies. So let's not build missile defense systems that give us an artificial notion of security, so we might be emboldened to use nuclear weapons. Then the Soviet Union went away. In one fell swoop, arms control stopped being to our advantage, because we were the sole remaining superpower on the face of the earth, and we weren't about to concede our military supremacy, especially in the area of strategic nuclear weapons. So arms control became inconvenient. This is why in 2001, George W. Bush withdrew from the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, because he said, oh no, we need to build a missile defense against rogue nations like North Korea, like Iran. And the Russians went, wait a minute, what happened to that old principle that we don't want to have ballistic missile defenses, because that creates a situation where one side might get an advantage over the other. If you start building ballistic missile defenses, those defenses could threaten Russia. Therefore, we would have to pull out of all of our strategic arms control agreements with you and build up our force to defeat your missile system, which is the arms race that everybody wanted to avoid. We promised the Russians that this would have nothing to do with them. Well, to make a long story short, earlier this month, we tested what's called a Standard Missile 3 Block 2A, just an advanced version of a surface-to-air missile that has been reconfigured to be an anti-ballistic missile capability, and we used it to shoot down an intercontinental ballistic missile-type target, which means that we now have fielded a missile defense system that can shoot down Russian missiles, something we told the Russians we would never do. We've done it, and we can deploy it on ships around the world and on ground-based stations around the world overnight. These are very mobile facilities. So the Russians are looking at this saying, you lied to us. You lied to us. And how can we trust you? And the same thing, you look at Donald Trump, the INF Treaty became inconvenient to the United States because we wanted to build intermediate missiles to counter what we deemed to be a Chinese threat. So we withdrew from the treaty. The Joint Comprehensive Program of Action, the Iran nuclear deal, inconvenient. We withdrew from that. Open the skies, inconvenient. We withdrew that. We've withdrawn from every single arms control agreement save one. The new START Treaty, which expires in February of next year. The Russians now have no incentive to extend this treaty. Why? Because the United States just tested a ballistic missile capable of shooting down Russian missiles. Why would Russia enter an agreement that calls for a further reduction of its nuclear deterrent capability at the same time that the United States is fielding a ballistic missile defense shield globally that can shoot down Russian missiles? It would be insanity. So it's not just what Trump did. It's what people have done prior to Trump, and it's what Biden's going to be struggling with going forward. That arms control is a major inconvenience to the United States so long as the United States seeks to define itself as the sole remaining superpower on the face of the earth. At some point in time, the United States is going to recognize that there are peer and near-peer powers out there, Russia and China, and we're going to have to take arms control seriously. But at that point in time, nobody's going to trust us. Nobody's going to believe us. Our word is no longer our bond because we have a proven track record of pulling out of arms control agreements, of violating arms control agreements when it becomes convenient for us to do so.
You know, what you're talking about is quite mind-boggling. The average person doesn't quite grasp, I believe, the concept of arms control. Would you agree?
No, I agree. And one of the reasons is that they don't grasp the threat posed by these weapons. We live in a little security bubble here at home where we think because we can go to Walmart and we can go to Price Chopper, we can go to stores and get food on demand, we can order from Amazon and things appear in the mail, that that's what life is about. They don't realize how fragile life is and that all it takes is, you know, literally a flick of a switch, a push of a button, and all of that comes to a screaming halt. They don't recognize that today, thanks to the United States, we have put Russia in a situation where if they receive notice of a launch, a missile launch, from a submarine off the coast of the Barents Sea or in the Arctic, Russia, they have less than 8 minutes to decide whether or not this is a fake report or if this is the real deal. And during that 8 minutes, they're probably going to launch a massive retaliatory strike against all of America, which means the life is over. That's 8 minutes. 8 minutes. Most Americans don't realize that we are literally 8 minutes away from global annihilation every second of the day, every minute of the day, every hour of the day, thanks to the United States of America, which has done away with the very treaty vehicles designed to prevent this from happening.
Now, back in 1962, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it went on for, I believe, over a week. And people were fearful at that time that we were on the brink then. Are we more, is humanity more threatened now than we were back in 1962?
Well, absolutely. Back in 1962, the Russians had no more than a handful of missiles they could have fired if they could have fired them. Their bombers would very likely have been shot down before they got to our shore. The missiles that could have been launched from Cuba would have killed millions of Americans, destroyed a number of cities, but we would have survived as a nation. Today, no. If there's a nuclear war, you know, the Russians have literally, you know, tens of thousands of warheads. It might be less than that now, but thousands of warheads that can be targeted against the United States. Every major urban city environment, every industrial location, anything of economic value in America will be destroyed. Life will end as we know it. This is the reality that we exist in. Most Americans aren't aware of that. Moreover, the relationship between the United States and Russia militarily is far more complex. Back then, you know, life was a little bit simpler, weapon systems, etc. Today, you know, everything depends on satellites detecting, making a proper call, on communications working, on, you know, people staring at a screen, making the right decision. The potential for somebody to get it wrong is far greater today than it was back then. One would think that that's sort of, you know, that shouldn't be the case, because you know, modern technology should give us great great capabilities. No, modern technology complicates it greatly and makes it far more difficult for the human to make the right decision, because at the end of the day, you really don't want to trust global survival to a computer, to artificial intelligence. Global survival should be trusted to the gut instinct of a human with a family who knows the wrong call, everything ends today, right now. And fortunately, history has shown that humans do make that right call. There's a Russian, he's called the man who saved the world, a Russian who was in the op center, should have, under his training, authorized a massive nuclear retaliation against a ballistic missile track coming in. But he looked at it and he said, it makes no sense. Why would this happen? Why would they attack now? I'm going to wait. And it turned out that it was a mistake. And thank God he didn't push the button, or else you and I wouldn't be talking right now. We need humans to make that decision, but what we really need to do is make it so that we don't have to call upon humans to make that decision, so that they aren't confronted with these life and death decisions of such a grand nature. And we can only do that with arms control, with sitting down, with developing trust and confidence to put in verifiable mechanisms to reduce and hopefully someday eliminate all strategic nuclear weapons, all nuclear weapons in general. You know, that would be a good thing. There is literally no scenario that any sane human being can come up with that would justify the use of nuclear weapons today. And if that's the reality, and it is, then why do we have them?
Okay, you're talking about nuclear weapons, and you talk about technology. You know, since I'm going to use 1962 again, technology has, you know, improved, if that's the right word, on weapon systems. And one of the weapon systems that was used during, I'm sure it's still being used today, is the drones. The drones. Obama was pretty, you know, adamant, and he used drone warfare a lot. But would you include drones in your arms control treaty?
It probably not. And this is why I would say that. You know, the United States uses drones to kill people that live in low tech countries. It's not a weapon that Russia needs to fear. If the United States tried to employ its drones against a nation possessing a modicum of modern self-defense technology, the drones would get shot down, the drone operators would be killed because long-range precision strikes would be brought in, tracking the signal back down to their control station. The drones themselves would be jammed, wrong signals brought down by forcing their engines to shut off. There's a whole bunch of things that can be done to shut a drone down. The drone is a horrible weapon if you're an Afghan civilian, a Yemeni civilian, a Syrian civilian, or an Iraqi civilian, because we use it overwhelmingly against Somali civilians, against these targets, and those civilian populations pay. But the way you control drones isn't so much about arms control, because they don't pose an existential threat to nations. You control it through greater definition and enforcement of the law of war. I mean, the law of war is supposed to protect civilians from, you know, from undue harm during times of conflict. The drone is a very is a weapon that doesn't discriminate very well, especially in the way that's used. You know, Obama created a mechanism that allowed drone strikes to be authorized based upon pretty much a hunch. You know, how many vehicles drove by today? How many women did you see? And you were allowed to draw a hunch that maybe somebody of value is down there. Wow. Now, if I did that as a Marine, if I was a Marine in combat with a mortar a section, and I said, well, I'm going to fire these mortars into this marketplace on a hunch, and I killed 25 to 75 civilians, I would be arrested and rightfully prosecuted as a war criminal by my own government, because I violated the laws of war.
Right.
And give drone operators the ability to do this. And that's where you need to control drones, through rules, regulations, and basically you need leadership that has strong moral fiber. The Obama administration did not possess strong moral fiber. They took the easy way out. They used drones because it was the easy thing to do, low risk to American service members. And the reality is, no cares about dead brown people. That's just the fact. I mean, we can sit here and say you and I care, but at the end of the day, America's compassion needle isn't going to be moved one iota by blowing up a wedding party of 75 Afghans. Just isn't. Now, if we blew up a wedding party of 75 Germans or 75 Frenchmen, that would be different. If a terrorist beheads one person in a French church, it's a global crisis. But if the United States fires a drone, kills 75 people in an Afghan wedding, no one cares. It just doesn't move the compassion needle at all. And that's a sad state of affairs. That doesn't reflect well on us as a people or a nation, but it's reality.
You know, what I find so alarming about that was when Obama first ascended to the presidency, he won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And then he was using drones like he was giving out candy. I found that unconscionable. And the worst part is, since he's left office, him and his wife have raked in millions and millions of dollars. I mean, millions and millions of dollars to be a mass murderer. I find that not really that much amusing. So that's my thought.
Well, look, it's not just the bottom line is every president since Bill Clinton, since the end of the Cold War, every president is engaged in interventionist policies that have killed millions of civilians. I mean, Bill Clinton's policy of strangling Iraq with sanctions during the 1990s, 500,000 children died. Madeleine Albright didn't even blink an eye. See, no, it's worth the price. Worth the price to do that. Really, mass starvation is worth the price. That's a policy the United States wants to embrace as a nation? The mass starvation of children? I think not. George W. Bush, I mean, we don't even have to talk about what he did, illegally invading and occupying Iraq, killing hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people. That's a war crime on a scale that should boggle the mind of any American. But no, we continue to treat him as, an ex-president who is deserving of respect. And then there's Barack Obama, the man who basically made murder an everyday attraction. I mean, and this is a man who stared the camera and said about drone warfare, "I guess I found out I'm actually pretty good at killing people." He said that. That's a quote. So he pretty much confesses to his murders, and yet we hold him up. They gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. And today he makes millions of dollars as this great statesman, when the reality is he should be disgraced, prosecuted, and possibly imprisoned for what he did. Almost every American president should be. Donald Trump should be. He's authorized similar illegal strikes. And I can guarantee you that Joe Biden will be a war criminal before his term is up. He will do things which violate international law, probably violate the American law. Barack Obama, keep in mind, killed, assassinated American citizens. Assassinated American citizens without due process, without the involvement of the court. That's murder. That's a violation of constitutional rights. Nothing. America just says, "Oh no, it's okay," because the guys he killed were brown, Yemenis, Saudis. We don't care about them. But the fact of the matter is, the American presidency has been turned into Murder Incorporated, and it doesn't matter who sits in the White House unless they're willing to fundamentally change the way we do business. They'll be part of that Murder Incorporated.
What's interesting is the fact that Barack Obama is a man of color. He's half African American, actually half African and half American. So, you know, and he had no allegiance to the brown and black community. Would you agree?
Barack Obama is an anomaly. You know, yes, his father was African from Kenya. His mother was a white American. But, he grew up in Hawaii. He attended Punahou, which is one of the most elite schools in Hawaii, a state where being non-white makes you the majority. You know, the whites are the minority in Hawaii. So he grew up privileged. He then attended Harvard. He's a privileged man. So to sit here and somehow pretend that because of the shade of Barack Obama's skin, he has a kinship with, you know, African Americans is just an absurdity. Yes, he went to Chicago. Yes, he was on a council, city council, and he did things. But he did it from the perspective of an elite, not as somebody who was raised in the inner city of America, somebody who knows what it was like to live in a drug-infested neighborhood, somebody who could empathize with the reality of a city's population. This was an elite coming in, dictating a solution to people, not having anything in common with them, except maybe the shade of his skin. But, you know, saying that because Barack Obama is a man of color, he should somehow empathize with other people of color is an absurdity. He's more privileged than most white people in America. And he is a product of, the system that produces American elites. He is the prototypical American elite.
Wow. On that note, we have to, stop our conversation. But I'm sure, we will continue as you continue writing, and we'll talk about what you're writing and what you're thinking on All Exits Closed. I look forward to talking with you again. Scott, have a great Thanksgiving, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a good day.
Thank you.